to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and on the World Wide Web at kpfk.org.
Night on, lady bright, in the arms of night.
Fighting for the very soul of America, and we will win!
KPFA, Sounds of Resistance, since 1949.
This is 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF Fresno, online, kpfa.org.
Friday, April 17th, and day one of a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon. Meanwhile, Iran reopens the Strait of Hormuz. Lawmakers in the U.S. extend FISA and the controversial section allowing warrantless spying overseas to the end of the month as Republicans and Democrats talk about reforms. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer rejects calls to resign after learning his ambassador to the U.S., Peter Mandelson, with ties to the late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, failed security clearances, but Starmer was never informed.
Not only was I not told, no minister was told. And I'm absolutely furious about that.
Vermont Independent Senator speaks out with a dire warning about the risk and threats of artificial intelligence. Tesla founder Elon Musk takes OpenAI to court, claiming it's not living up to its mission as a nonprofit. News on these stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Christina Onnestad. It's day one of a ceasefire between the governments of Israel and Lebanon. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today said the job isn't done. He said Iran's allies in Lebanon, Hezbollah, have been beaten back and simultaneously hailed peace talks with Lebanon's government, the first in decades. Hezbollah says it will not abide by the ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump said the leaders of the two countries could travel to Washington to meet in the next couple of weeks. The Strait of Hormuz is once again open for commercial shipping. Iran announced the reopening of the strait this morning. It's welcome news, offering hopes of more economic stability and perhaps broader peace negotiations to end the war. But U.S. President Donald Trump says the U.S. blockade of Iran will continue. As other world leaders convene today to discuss reopening the strait, Christopher Martinez reports.
The announcement of that reopening of the Strait of Hormuz was greeted with relief by leaders from around the world. United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres welcomed the announcement as a step in the right direction. Spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric read the Secretary General's statement.
The Secretary General remains fully supportive of the diplomatic efforts to find a peaceful path forward out of the current conflict. He also hopes that together with the ceasefire, this measure will contribute to creating confidence between the parties and strengthen the ongoing dialogue being facilitated by Pakistan.
The reopening of the strait has raised hopes that it's an indicator of bigger things to come. Agreements on keeping the strait open to shipping permanently, renewed negotiations, and a peaceful diplomatic end to the conflict. Those are the hopes. the reality may be a bit more complicated. After Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, announced the opening of the strait, President Donald Trump initially welcomed it, but later he added a twist, telling reporters in Phoenix that the U.S. blockade of Iranian ships and ports will continue until Iran agrees to a deal to end the war.
When the agreement is signed, the blockade ends. As soon as the agreement gets signed, that's when the blockade ends.
Trump has suggested a second round of talks with Iran could take place this weekend. As for Iran, a spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry, Ismail Baghaei, said on Iranian state TV, if they continue with what they call a naval blockade, surely the Islamic Republic of Iran will take necessary reciprocal measures. He added, the Islamic Republic of Iran is the guardian of the Strait of Hormuz, and wherever it is necessary, it will not compromise in implementing measures that guarantee the rights of the Iranian people. Meanwhile, in Paris, European leaders welcomed the reopening. They were attending a gathering of 49 countries, but not the United States, to discuss a neutral mission to keep the strait open. It's called the Strait of Hormuz Maritime Freedom of Navigation Initiative. Several European leaders spoke to the press Friday. French President Emmanuel Macron referred to the ceasefire and the reopening of the strait, saying, the recent events are encouraging, even though we have to be cautious.
So all of this goes in the right direction, although we note that the Iranian authorities have set a timetable for the opening up of the Hormuz Strait, and that America is still blocking Iranian ports and ships.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said the UK and France will lead a multinational mission to protect freedom of navigation in the strait as soon as conditions allow.
Our citizens need to see a return to peace and stability, and we will play our full part.
He says the international group showed real unity at Friday's meeting.
We want to see a return to talks and a lasting agreement, including the reopening of the strait. We welcome the announcement that was made during our meeting, but we need to make sure that that is both lasting and a workable proposal. And if anything, it reinforces the need for the work that we've been doing this afternoon, because we're very clear that the mission that we're putting together is a defensive mission and that comes after a ceasefire.
Italian Premier Giorgia Meloni also spoke, emphasizing that the initiative is purely defensive.
This initiative is also part of a much vaster effort, which shows that our countries are ready to meet the challenge of this cycle of crises that does not just impact the Middle East, but also Ukraine and other fronts. Italy will do everything possible to consolidate the ceasefire in Iran, which is precious, important, and was reached thanks to the negotiations between the USA and Iran. And it is important that these negotiations continue to put an end to the conflict in Iran.
All three European leaders have taken heavy criticism from President Trump for not joining his military action in the strait, as have other allies like Japan and Australia. And those are not the only allies feeling the pressure from Trump's war. The news outlet Politico is reporting that the war is damaging U.S. reputation and relations, especially in the Muslim world. It cites diplomatic cables from U.S. embassies saying that relations are faltering with Azerbaijan, and Indonesia is feeling pressure to reduce security ties with the U.S. In Bahrain, which hosts the headquarters of the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, the government is questioning whether the U.S. abandoned Bahrain to focus on protecting Israel instead. Nevertheless, the U.S. continues to go its own way, and other countries are increasingly looking at their own paths forward. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, who was at the gathering in Paris, said the war against Iran, in his words, raises challenges for us all.
This war must not turn into a transatlantic stress test. Therefore, I think we can draw a number of conclusions of this together, because the challenges I've just mentioned hit us all, impact all of the EU countries and beyond. And if we don't succeed in the initiatives we've taken, then there's the threat of a multidimensional global war.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In Gaza, despite a U.S. brokered ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, hundreds of items are still banned from entering the Gaza Strip, with no explanation by Israeli authorities. Among them, oil. As the cost of petroleum skyrockets from the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, Pacifica's Romy Almagari reports from Gaza.
Here in the central Gaza Strip, where more than 350,000 residents and displaced refugees live, a key healthcare provider is reducing its services due to lack of fuel that run its generators, which are its main source of power after Israel's bombing campaign destroyed much of Gaza's infrastructure. Dr. Khalil Al-Dukran is a spokesperson for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah.
Absolutely. It has affected our operations. Due to a shortage of oil and spare parts, we in the kidney department, we provide dialysis for only 2.5 people. Instead of 3 times a week, it is now only 2 times a week. Other departments are less vital, are now run with a certain schedule based upon available power, supply that is distributed among them around the clock.
Other vital services have been also impacted by the lack of oil that held power generators for water desalination plants, local power supply, and vehicles running on the battered streets of the war-torn territory. Shadi Abulroos is a spokesperson for the Al-Aruqi private-owned electricity company in the central Gaza Strip town of Megaza. The company provides electricity for around 2,800 subscribers, including homes and businesses.
Before the crisis, we used to provide electricity for 20 hours per day for commercial facilities and 16 hours for domestic use. During Eid and Ramadan, we provided homes with 20 hours of electricity. But after Eid, one of the generators broke down and we were forced to provide the population with only 6 hours or less per day.
Customers are now paying more for less. The price increased from 18 shekels to 25. Despite Israeli and sometimes American reports that goods and commodities regularly enter into the coastal enclave, local official sources in Gaza suggest that what enters barely meets the population needs. Ismail Thawabta is director of the government-run media office in Gaza.
We say that the ban on engine oil is a criminal act by the Israeli occupation that further aggravates the humanitarian crisis here in the Gaza Strip since the beginning of its genocidal war. We appeal to patrons of the ceasefire to pressure the Israeli occupation to allow all needed materials in, especially engine oil.
In the Gaza Strip's marketplaces, locals can buy various goods and commodities, but for high prices that the majority of the Palestinian population cannot afford, despite the ceasefire 6 months ago. Gaza's civilian population continues to bear the brunt of the Israel-Hamas conflict. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Al-Mighari, in Gaza.
Israel's war in Gaza has inflicted a far higher toll on women and girls than in previous conflicts in the Palestinian enclave, with more than 38,000 killed by Israeli air and land military strikes since Hamas's massacre in southern Israel that sparked the war 2.5 years ago. This, according to the UN's Women Agency. It said today at least 22,000 women and 16,000 girls on average of at least 47 are killed every day in Gaza. Sophia Kaltorp is a chief of humanitarian action.
Those killed were mothers, they were daughters, sisters, and friends, deeply loved by those around them.
The troll toll is likely higher because many bodies are still trapped under rubble, the UN women said. Data also finds nearly 11,000 women and girls have been injured, and many have life-changing disabilities. According to Gaza's health authorities, more than 72,300 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, another 172,000 injured, which has created a chronic humanitarian emergency where many households are now headed by women who are facing increased economic hardship and protection risks. Kaltorp says there's a complete lack of most services and stressed an urgent need for the basics in Gaza, including sexual and reproductive health and access to sanitary pads.
There is a complete lack of most services, and particularly I would say those services that are needed for women, that is sexual and reproductive health and rights, that's access to sanitary pads, that's access to the most basics. I mean, when I was in Gaza in November, I met two women who had to deliver on the street because there were no transportations to bring them to any functional hospitals.
UN Women is calling for a respect of the ceasefire and adherence to international law and scaled up humanitarian assistance, stressing women and girls must be at the center of recovery and peace-building efforts. Sudan's civil war now in its fourth year. Sudanese people badly needing food and other humanitarian supplies that are under strain, according to the United Nations. Sudan still described as the world's worst, largest humanitarian catastrophe, notably in terms of displacement and hunger, with no end in sight, as fighting between the military and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, continues to lay waste to parts of the vast Darfur region. Growing evidence shows regional powers like the United Arab Emirates backing rival combatants behind the scenes. Attempts by the U.S. and regional powers, now distracted by the Iran war, have failed to establish any kind of ceasefire. Sudan's civil war has been called an abandoned crisis as a new Middle East conflict throws shadows on the fighting that's forced 13 million people to flee their homes. 59,000 have been killed. At least 6,000 have died over 3 days as RSF rampaged through the Darfur outpost of El Fasher last October. The UN-backed experts say an offensive there bore the defining characteristics of genocide. Hussein Mohammed Sharif says he was hit by a sniper that left him unable to use his right arm.
I was in Omdurman and was shot by a sniper from the Rapid Support Forces. He was in a building, shooting and killing people. I was hit by a bullet and fell to the ground. I was shot at the right side, which caused me hemiplegia. I came to Port Sudan to receive treatment, and there was a man who directed me to seek treatment in Cairo.
The war has pushed parts of Sudan into famine. The number of people with severe acute malnutrition is expected to increase to 800,000, according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. The UN says about 34 million people, or about 2 out of 3 Sudanese, need assistance. At a center for malnourished children in the Red Sea city of Port Sudan, people have waited for hot food to be distributed. At a camp for displaced people, people who fled their homes in violence are living in makeshift shelters with their families waiting for the violence to stop, as fuel prices have increased more than 24% in Sudan, driving the cost of providing aid. A Russian drone strike injured at least 7 people, including a child, in the southern Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia today. Officials say an 8-year-old boy was among the injured and diagnosed with an acute stress reaction. 4 people in total were hospitalized. Mattia Shamel, UN's resident humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine, said it's the second day in a row of strikes from Russia to hit the area.
We heard the loud explosions I understand two people are killed, two civilians. One is still missing, buried somewhere under the rubble. They are searching for this individual. At least 30 people injured. The governor just told us 15 critically. This is unacceptable. I cannot understand how there can be any justification for hitting the middle of a built-up city like this. This madness has to stop.
The attack comes a day after overnight strikes across Ukraine and the Donbass in capital Kiev killed at least 16 people and injured more than 100. Explosions were reported across major urban centers, causing civilian casualties and damage to residential and civilian infrastructure. Death toll is expected to rise as emergency services continued search and rescue operations. Nearly 700 drones and dozens of ballistic and cruise missiles were used in what's being described as the largest attack by Russia in 2 weeks. Ukrainian officials acknowledged vital stocks of interceptors are running low. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky today warned Ukraine faces risks to deliveries of air defense systems amid the conflict in the Middle East. Officials have warned of a lowering supply of jet fuel in Europe as the Strait of Hormuz, which 20% of the world's supply ships through, is semi-closed with severely limited shipping traffic. Meanwhile, Russia today said an oil depot was hit by a Ukrainian strike. The International Court of Justice celebrated 80 years today. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres gave a speech and warned with brutal conflicts around the world, from Gaza to Iran, Lebanon, Sudan, Myanmar, Ukraine, all appearing to throw international law to the winds. That law is eroding.
When the law of force replaces the force of law, instability becomes contagious. Conflicts spill across borders. Economic shocks reverberate around the world, and the most vulnerable always suffer first and suffer most.
And Antonio Guterres, United Nations Secretary General. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is resisting calls to resign after it emerged his former ambassador to the United States, Peter Mandelson, was initially denied security clearance for the job. Mandelson was eventually fired from his role over close links to the disgraced sex predator Jeffrey Epstein. Following the revelation in the Guardian newspaper Thursday, the government said Starmer had not been aware the Foreign Office overruled a security vetting process for Mandelson until earlier this week. Starmer's previously insisted due process was followed and Mandelson had lied about the extent of his links to Epstein.
That I wasn't told that Peter Mandelson had failed security vetting when he's appointed, is staggering. That I wasn't told that he'd failed security vetting when I was telling Parliament that due process had been followed is unforgivable. Not only was I not told, no minister was told. And I'm absolutely furious about that. What I intend to do is to go to Parliament on Monday to set out all the relevant facts in true transparency so Parliament has the full picture.
After it was revealed in the latest dump of Epstein files that Mandelson shared national security secrets with Epstein, Starmer's chief of staff, who recommended Mandelson for the position, resigned. There's growing speculation Epstein was an intelligence asset or operative. Mandelson, a longtime politician in the Labour Party, now under investigation. He was arrested in February on suspicion of misconduct in public office and released on bail. He's denied doing anything improper and has not been charged. Days before his arrest, former Prince Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, was also arrested on the same charge related to his connections to Jeffrey Epstein. King Charles III's younger brother was a close associate of Epstein. In late 2024, Starmer appointed Mandelson to the ambassador post, despite knowing his previous relationship with Epstein. Mandelson's trade expertise was considered a major asset in trying to persuade the Trump administration not to slap heavy tariffs on British goods, and seemed to pay off when the country struck a trade deal a few months later. Starmer fired Mandelson in September over an earlier revelation of his longer-standing ties to Epstein. Immigration Enforcement and Customs Enforcement Acting Director Todd Lyons will resign at the end of May. Lyons is a key executor of President Donald Trump's mass deportation agenda, overseeing violent and deadly operations by federal immigration agents deployed to Democratic cities since President Trump took office, including in Minneapolis, Chicago, and Los Angeles. Under its leadership, the agency, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, was granted a massive infusion of cash through the GOP-controlled Congress, which ICE used to expand hiring and detention capabilities, and ramped up arrests until backlash erupted over the fatal shootings of two American protesters at the hands of federal immigration officers. Lyons and two other top immigration officials testified before a House subcommittee Thursday to argue for the agency's budget and face continued scrutiny from Democratic lawmakers who still have the entire Department of Homeland Security in a partial shutdown over demands for reforms of its agents' tactics that include no mask wearing, showing identity, and warrants signed by a judge before raiding people's homes. During the hearing, Texas Democrat Henry Cuellar questioned a part of the budget that seeks to create another law enforcement agency. He had this exchange with Joseph Edlow, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Director.
Why do we need 200 agents specifically for your agency? What is it that ICE or other folks are telling you no, that you feel there's a need to create a new law enforcement part of it in your agency?
Thank you, Mr. Cuellar. No one's telling us no, but with all due respect to my colleague, Mr. Lyons, HSI has a very large portfolio. What I'm trying to create here is a very narrow criminal investigation branch that is going to focus specifically on immigration fraud and entitlement fraud that falls within our purview.
Lyons also faced a grilling, including questions over the shooting deaths of Renee Good and Alex Preti. He was asked if he would apologize for the way some of the administration officials characterized Good as a domestic terrorist. He declined to do so. Representative Lauren Underwood of Illinois, one of the states besieged by federal immigration agents under Lyons' watch, blasted what she said was a lack of accountability of ICE agents' brutality.
You can't or won't rein in your agents, and you are obstructing state and local investigations. From record-breaking deaths in custody to the killing of U.S. citizens at the hands of federal agents, it could not possibly be clearer that your agencies are out of control. The patterns of reckless, incompetent, cruel, illegal, corrupt, and unconstitutional behavior across your agencies and the total lack of accountability to Congress, the American people, and the Constitution, in my opinion, these are leadership problems, not funding problems.
After taking helm of ICE, Lyons signed off on a memo that granted federal immigration officers sweeping powers to forcibly enter homes and make arrests without a judge's warrant. Public perception of ICE during this time shows low support. A February Associated Press NORC poll shows most U.S. adults, including independents, said they have an unfavorable view of the agency. Lyons' departure also comes as DHS is under new leadership after President Trump fired former Secretary Kristi Noem, who led the department through the administration's major immigration policy changes. Former Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, who took over as secretary last month, likely to continue to advance the president's agenda, but has sought to strike a softer tone on some of the administration's most contentious policies. The Associated Press is reporting some new ICE officers have started working before passing background checks, and some had problems in their past. ICE announced in January it completed an unprecedented hiring spree, adding 12,000 officers and agents to double its force. The mission, to carry out the president's mass deportation campaign. The speed with which they were brought on to payroll to jobs considered important for national security, though, has raised alarm. The AP found one new ICE hire had filed for bankruptcy twice and worked for six different law enforcement agencies in 3 years. Another was accused of lying in a police report to justify a felony charge against an innocent woman. A third quit his only prior policing job after 3 weeks. 15 people deported from the U.S. have landed in Congo's capital, Kinshasa. A lawyer says the deportation is part of the administration's agreement with African countries to speed up migrant removals. The deportees are from Latin America and have legal protections from U.S. judges shielding them against being returned to their home countries. The deportees are believed to be staying at a hotel. Congo's ministry said in a statement it will receive some migrants as part of a new deal under the administration's third country program. The U.S. has struck these deportation deals with at least seven other African nations, many of them among countries hit hardest by the administration's policies restricting trade, aid, and migration. Some of the governments have poor human rights records, including Eswatini, South Sudan, and Equatorial Guinea. You are listening to the Pacifica Evening News from KPFA, 94.1 FM, KPFB, 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF, 88.1 FM in Fresno, and KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A. It's an hour-long newscast that airs each night.
And, you know, I did pretty well, except there were a few mistakes that I made that I have just recently cleared up.
Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings, every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Let that love supreme reign over the universe.
Thank you for listening to 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, and around the globe at kpfk.org.
Controversial surveillance program used by U.S. spy agencies today, just days before it was set to expire Monday. This after a long night of debates, the House passed a short-term extension of FISA. The Senate passed it today. The action came in a post-midnight session after Republicans revolted and refused President Trump's push for a longer extension. Republican leaders late Thursday had rushed out last-minute changes and called lawmakers back for a middle-of-the-night vote. Their proposal would have extended the program for 5 years with some revisions, but the efforts collapsed.
Are you kidding me? Who the hell is running this place?
Democratic Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts blasted the five-year extension. At the center of the controversy is Section 702 of the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which permits the CIA, the National Security Agency, the FBI, and other agencies to collect and analyze vast amounts of overseas communications without a warrant.
A five-year reauthorization, 5 years, and Republicans threw it together on the back of a napkin in a back room in the middle of the night. There have been real bipartisan discussions about adding civil liberties and safeguards. Some members support them, some oppose them, but just about everyone agrees that this is serious stuff, the kind of debate that Congress ought to have in the open. Instead, Republican leadership just jammed us. Does anybody actually know what the hell is in this thing?
Lawmakers then turn to a short-term extension of the program. It sets the stage for another showdown in a matter of weeks. expiring April 30th. The measure cleared the Senate by voice vote today without a formal roll call, the same way it was approved hours earlier in the House. Senate Majority Leader John Thune gave a nod to the political difficulty ahead, as Congress will continue debates of the surveillance tool that pits Americans' privacy rights against what U.S. officials have long said is an effective program for the security of the country. Oregon Democrat Senator Ron Wyden, a longtime critic of the surveillance system, stalled further action in the Senate as he pressed for changes. In the House, Republicans also sought changes, new provisions to ensure only FBI attorneys could authorize queries on Americans and to require the Office of the Director of National Intelligence to review such cases, according to Representative Austin Scott of Georgia, who said the changes would also enhance criminal penalties on those who unlawfully conduct inquiries or disclose surveillance information. It provides proceedings of FISA court, which handles those requests.
We cannot allow Section 702 to lapse. Not at a moment where our adversaries are expanding their capabilities, accelerating their operations, and exploiting every gap in our intelligence posture. Allowing this authority to expire would leave the United States blind to threats that move at the speed of the modern conflict.
But the 14-page amendment backed by Scott did not go far enough for some holdouts in the Republican Party and for many Democrats. GOP leaders then tried to salvage a shorter 18-month renewal that President Trump had demanded and that House Speaker Mike Johnson had supported. That failed as well, with some 20 Republicans joining most Democrats in blocking its advance. By 2 o'clock this morning, the House agreed to a 10-day extension. It's a recurring fight. Lawmakers will weigh civil liberty concerns against intelligence officials' warnings about national security risks in the days ahead. Trump and his allies had lobbied aggressively all week for a clean renewal without changes, without success. A federal judge in Oakland has set a trial date of May 8th for Tesla CEO Elon Musk's lawsuit against OpenAI, alleging the ChatGPT parent company's founders violated its founding mission as a research organization in favor of a for-profit company for their own benefit. Max Pringle reports.
Elon Musk claims in the lawsuit that he was a co-founder and co-chair of OpenAI back in 2015. And contributed $40 million in seed money to get the company up and running. Musk said he's seeking around $150 million in damages that he wants to contribute to OpenAI's nonprofit charity arm. He told CNBC recently that he basically came up with the idea for OpenAI.
I came up with a name. Right. The name OpenAI refers to open source. So the intent was, what's the opposite of Google would be an open source nonprofit, because Google is closed sourced for profit. And that profit motivation can be potentially dangerous.
Musk also wants OpenAI CEO Sam Altman and President Greg Brockman to be removed from the company's board as a condition of the lawsuit. Altman recently told podcaster Lex Fridman that Musk is bitter that the other founders of the company would not give him total control over it.
He thought OpenAI was going to fail. He wanted total control to sort of turn it around. We wanted to keep going in the direction that now has become OpenAI. He also wanted Tesla to be able to build an AGI effort. At various times, he wanted to make OpenAI into a for-profit company that he could have control of or have it merge with Tesla. We didn't want to do that, and he decided to leave, which that's fine.
Musk initially launched a lawsuit against OpenAI in 2024, claiming that the business had become what he called a closed-source, de facto subsidiary of Microsoft when it dropped its nonprofit designation. He claims that, as co-chair of the OpenAI founding group, the change to a for-profit operation defrauded him as a donor. As a result, he's now claiming that he, or apparently the remaining nonprofit side of OpenAI, deserve a portion of the company's current valuation. After parting ways with OpenAI, Musk started xAI in 2023 as a competitor. He made an unsolicited bid to acquire OpenAI for about $97 billion in February of last year. The New Yorker recently reported that Musk was involved in reconstituting OpenAI as a for-profit company back in 2017. He then demanded control over any for-profit company. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
Gunmen shot at the San Francisco home of OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, according to the San Francisco Police Department. That came 2 days after a 20-year-old man allegedly threw a Molotov cocktail at the property. San Francisco Police Department said it arrested Amanda Tom and Mohammed Tariq Hussein, who were booked for negligent discharge of a firearm. OpenAI has not commented on the incident, according to an initial police report. The police report said the person in the passenger seat of the vehicle put their hand out a window and appeared to fire a round on the Lombard site of the property. The motorist fled. A camera captured the license plate. Artificial intelligence will upend white-collar work and some blue-collar work in the coming years. It was a topic of a discussion between Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, and labor union officials Thursday. KPFA's Joan Walsh reports.
Senator Bernie Sanders warns blue-collar workers, especially transportation workers, will likely lose their jobs as driverless vehicles are being increasingly used and spreading to cities rapidly.
What experts tell us, if there is not a counter-reaction, it is very likely that millions and millions of truck drivers, bus drivers, taxi cab drivers will lose their jobs within the next decade.
AI will also impact white-collar workers. Microsoft AI CEO Mustafa Suleiman estimates white-collar work will be fully automated by AI within the next 18 months. Professions such as lawyer, accountant, coder, engineer, and administrator are some of the jobs anticipated to be at risk. Sanders says the AI oligarchs pushing this new technology are the richest people in the world, such as Elon Musk, who owns Tesla and SpaceX, Mark Zuckerberg, owner of Meta, Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, and Larry Ellison, owner of Oracle. They are pushing for technologies to replace human workers to cut labor costs and reap more profits.
If I have a robot and it costs me $30,000, $20,000 for a robot, and that robot works 24 hours a day, doesn't get a salary, doesn't get a vacation, doesn't get sick, man, what a good investment. I've cut my quote-unquote labor cost probably by 90%.
Liz Schuler, president of the American Federation of Labor and Congress, says the rise of artificial intelligence is driving fear and anxiety across the American workforce.
This race that everybody seems to think we're in to advance AI at all costs with no guardrails or protections for people is reckless and dangerous.
Schuler notes workers are already seeing this technology in their workplace, such as nurses, educators, writers, retail, office workers, grocery workers, and bus drivers. She says there is no industry that AI does not touch. For KPFA News, I'm Joan Walsh.
Maine's legislature passed the nation's first statewide moratorium on energy-hungry data centers that are stoking fears about blackouts, rising energy bills, and adverse environmental impacts from voracious water needs to meet the needs of artificial intelligence. Lawmakers Tuesday approved sending the one-year ban to Maine's Governor Janet Mills, a Democrat who's running for U.S. Senate. It's a latest sign of increasingly stiff opposition at the local level. That is growing. Tech giants and the data centers they're building have high-level support from President Trump's administration and some governors who see them as economic engines and essential for winning the AI race with China, even as voters raise concerns about the enormous amount of power data centers use. Proposals to slap moratoriums on data centers have been introduced in at least a dozen states, but other than Maine, none have yet passed a legislative chamber. Maine's legislation would institute a moratorium for more than a year on data centers above a certain size and create a special counsel to help towns vet potential projects. The Supreme Court handed a big win to oil and gas companies today, fighting lawsuits over coastal loss and environmental degradation in Louisiana. The unanimous procedural decision gives the companies a new day in federal court after a state jury ordered Chevron to pay upwards of $740 million to clean up damage to the state's coastline, one of multiple similar lawsuits. The companies were backed by the Trump administration and argue the case belongs in federal court because they began oil production and refining during World War II as U.S. contractors. Louisiana's coastal parishes have lost more than 2,000 square miles of land over the last century. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, which has also identified oil and gas infrastructure as a significant cause, the state could lose an additional 3,000 square miles in the coming decades, its Coastal Protection Agency has warned. The litigation over the role of oil and gas companies has crossed typical political lines in that state. The hefty jury award came from a community in one of the most conservative pro-energy parts of Louisiana. According to Republican Attorney General Liz Merle, Republican Governor Jeff Landry, a longtime oil and gas industry supporter, also backed the lawsuits when he was attorney general. Local Louisiana leaders remain determined to keep the litigation alive despite that setback. CalSTRS, the California Teachers Pension Fund, has significantly reduced its fossil fuel investments since the year 2022, according to a new report from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. Over the past 4 years, CalSTRS has moved over $30 billion, one-fifth of its public equity assets, into a low-carbon portfolio that excludes the top five global oil and gas companies, including ExxonMobil and Chevron. It also scales back investments in other fossil fuels. Fossil-free executive director Quinn Eade said in a statement, quote, CalSTRS set an example for other pensions by taking big oil out of 20% of its portfolio. Now it's past time to do the same with the other 80% of investments, and past time for CalPERS to follow suit, unquote. CalPERS is a state employees' pension fund. A bill that would allow the state attorney general to go after big oil companies for insurance-related costs to climate disasters has cleared a key committee in the state legislature. Suzanne Potter has more.
Senate Bill 982 would authorize the attorney general to sue to recover damages after a natural disaster linked to climate change, like floods or wildfire. A new climate disaster fund could stabilize the state's FAIR plan, which is the insurer of last resort in areas that have been abandoned by commercial insurance carriers. Marisa Aguayo lost her San Diego area home in a flood in 2024. She says her $250,000 insurance policy was insufficient, and then the company canceled her policy altogether.
It was complete devastation. The insurance process felt like being re-victimized. And it feels like we're living in a state of overwhelm every single day.
The Western State Petroleum Association calls the Affordable Insurance and Recovery Act a $32 billion climate tax that could raise the cost of energy production and lead to higher prices for gas and utilities. Supporters say something has to be done to save the FAIR plan, which has tripled in size since 2021 and currently insures nearly $700 billion worth of property. Louise Belli from Santa Ana says homeowners insurance has shot up since the L.A. fires, even for people far from the burn scar.
The oil companies can help solve this problem. There is going to be more climate-related disasters in the future. Someone's going to have to pay for it, and I think they should be held accountable.
Studies have linked the burning of fossil fuels to climate change and have tied climate change to the rising frequency of extreme weather events. Belli says average homeowners shouldn't have to bear the cost of climate change.
The attorney general would ensure that the oil and gas companies contribute to a climate disaster fund. It could be used for community resiliency efforts and for future climate-related disasters.
The AIR Act is co-sponsored by three nonprofit advocacy groups: Extreme Weather Survivors, California Environmental Voters, and the Center for Climate Integrity. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
California Assemblymember Matt Haney of San Francisco joined housing and labor advocates in San Diego this week to announce legislation that would combat the state's housing crisis and revitalize its downtowns. Jacques Leibarger-Martel reports.
Assemblymember Matt Haney spoke in San Diego Monday to introduce AB 2074, the Downtown High-Rise Act, aimed at building more high-density housing in California downtowns. Haney's proposal is endorsed by both the State Building and Construction Trades Council of California and by California YIMBY.
We're here as a broad coalition of housing advocates, of local leaders, and of labor leaders and workers with a very simple message, which is that downtowns need housing. Downtowns want housing. Downtowns are an incredible place to build more housing. And our state can do more to support cities like San Diego in getting that housing approved and built fast.
AB 2074 would require transit-rich California cities with populations over 400,000 to designate regional transit districts. Within those transit districts, cities will be prohibited from setting a building height limit of less than 150 feet. In at least a quarter of the area of each district, the maximum building height limit must not be less than 450 feet. Project proposals that meet California labor and affordability standards would be eligible for streamlined approval and for low-interest loans administered by the California Housing Finance Agency. Nolan Gray of the group California YIMBY describes AB 2074 as a win-win-win-win, saying it will simultaneously address issues facing housing, transit, and downtowns.
It will unlock tens of thousands of new homes in downtowns all across California, but it'll also unlock homes in the places that where it makes the most sense to build, in our downtowns, where we already have existing infrastructure and where we have high-quality transit that frankly needs ridership to sustain service. Of course, crucially, it'll revitalize downtowns. Too many of our California downtowns have parking lots or old one- or two-story buildings. They're just waiting for redevelopment. Again, win, win, win.
Chris Hannon, the president of the State Building and Construction Trades Council of California, said AB 2074 would help projects get started and that his members were eager to support it. Assemblymember Haney calls his bill an investment in the workforce and its training pipelines, which will be needed as buildings go up across the state. He acknowledged the controversy of high-rise proposals in less dense neighborhoods, but characterized his bill as a common-sense measure that he hopes Californians could come together and agree on.
There should be full and broad agreement that in places where you already have these high-rises, that we should make it easier to have a high-rise next that's about the same height that where people can live, where more people can be in our downtowns, where they can support small businesses, where they can take existing transit. That should be a win-win that everyone who is watching, however you felt about past housing bills, should be able to get behind.
AB 2074 passed the Assembly Housing Committee last week and will next go to the Committee on Local Government. For KPFA, I'm Jacques Leibarger-Martel.
Attorneys for the man accused of killing right-wing provocateur Charlie Kirk asked a judge to ban cameras from the courtroom as a case plays out. Defense witnesses for Tyler Robinson argued conjecture in the media over his guilt and depictions of him as a monster are making it impossible to get a fair trial. They said live broadcasts of the proceedings are tainting potential jurors by feeding into speculative stories based on Robinson's courtroom demeanor and alleged confessions. Media organizations, prosecutors, and Kirk's widow, Erica Kirk, are arguing and asking the court to allow cameras. They argue transparency is the best way to guard against the misinformation and conspiracy theories that concern Robinson's defense team. Robinson's parents sat behind him for a hearing today in a half-full courtroom. Prosecutors intend to seek the death penalty if Robinson is convicted of aggravated murder in the September 10th shooting of Kirk. The conservative activist was addressing a crowd of thousands on the Utah Valley University campus in Orem when he was shot in the neck. Kirk's father lowered his head and stared at his hands while the defense played a Fox News clip in which a commentator identified as a former FBI agent opined that Robinson was a sociopath. The 23-year-old turned himself in a day after the shooting and has not yet entered a plea, a trial date not yet been set. The judge said he would rule May 8th on whether cameras will continue to be allowed. The House passed legislation to extend temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants living in the U.S. Thursday, 224 to 204. It's a long-shot effort against President Trump's attempts to end status of TPS for several groups of immigrants, including Haitians. The legislation was backed by Democrats and about 10 Republicans who have large Haitian populations in their districts. Representative Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat of Massachusetts, is co-chair of the House Haiti Caucus, represents one of the largest Haitian communities in the country, and sponsored the bill. She noted a Haitian nurse helped her mother in her mother's last dying days.
I will not stand idly by while our Haitian neighbors are denigrated, dehumanized, criticized, or forced to live in fear of deportation. The unique care provided my mother and millions of people cannot be replaced by AI. Haitian TPS holders are not the problem, quite the contrary. They are part of the solution. They are not our enemies. They do not exploit our nation. They enhance it.
President Trump, who's falsely accused Haitians of eating people's pets in Ohio, would almost certainly veto it. The Supreme Court will soon hear a case that would end the protected status for Haitian and Syrian immigrants. Nearly all refugees admitted to the United States since October of 2025 have been white South Africans, according to federal data, reflecting the president's sweeping overhaul of the nation's resettlement program. Of more than 4,400 refugees resettled, all but three were South African, according to the Refugee Processing Center. In the final full fiscal year of the Biden administration, the U.S. admitted 125,000 refugees from 85 countries. Democrats in Congress are trying to overturn the Trump administration's changes to a student loan forgiveness program. The public service loan forgiveness cancels loans for workers at nonprofits and public schools and hospitals after a decade of payments. Last fall, the Trump administration wrote a rule allowing borrowers to be barred from the program if their employers are deemed to have a substantial illegal purpose. The rule targets organizations working with immigrants and transgender youth. This week, Democrats introduced resolutions to overturn the rule, calling it an attempt to intimidate certain organizations. The measure still unlikely to become law with Republican control in the legislature. California healthcare advocates are asking state lawmakers to protect transgender rights in the face of opposition from the Trump administration. Suzanne Potter reports.
Many people spoke at a recent joint budget hearing on access to gender-affirming care in California, asking for a $26 million budget investment. Ariela Cuellar is with the California LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network, part of the nonprofit Health Access California. She says $1 million would be used to keep transgender care covered under Medi-Cal.
So it would enable the Department of Healthcare Services to establish a state-only Medi-Cal billing and reimbursement pathway for gender-affirming care separate from federal financial participation to maintain the continuity of care for Medi-Cal beneficiaries.
The other $25 million would fund grants that would stabilize provider networks. Gender-affirming care, both for minors and adults, remains legal and protected in California. Youth are not allowed to undergo gender-affirming surgery without the consent of a parent or guardian. Last year, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services threatened to pull federal funding from any clinic that offers gender-affirming care for youth, arguing that it causes long-term irreparable harm. Several large California health centers complied and limited services for minors. Cuellar says the Golden State must take a stand.
California needs to support more education, advocacy, research. Trans folks have always existed and will continue to exist regardless of these efforts trying to eradicate a whole population.
The California LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network is also collaborating with Stanford University to address a lack of federal data and research. They have submitted a grant proposal to the California Initiative to Advance Precision Medicine. People can sign a letter in support of that proposal on the Stanford Pride Study website. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner this year will be sponsored by Grindr, the LGBTQ hookup app. This is the GOP tries to undo LGBTQ advances, specifically targeting trans rights. The Hill publication is reporting Grindr will host the inaugural White House Correspondents' Dinner weekend party the night before the main event, a night dubbed Nerd Prom over the years. A divided federal appeals court ruled a judge must end what it called his intrusive contempt investigation of the Trump administration for failing to comply with an order over flights carrying Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador last year. The majority of the three-judge D.C. appeals court ruled Chief Judge...
Peace, everybody. This is DJ Sean O, and you are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. I wanted to let you know you can check out Soundwaves Radio with host Val the Vandal and myself each and every Friday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles.
There are many ways to support the programs that you love on KPFK. Becoming a member, starting a monthly gift, donating a vehicle that you don't need anymore. And now, donating a piece of land.